So my guest today, John Urschel, played in the NFL, played professional football for the Baltimore Ravens, played as a linebacker. What it takes to succeed, to the work ethic, the talent, the extraordinary grit to get to the level where you're actually chosen and you're playing in the NFL is an astonishing story on its own. But that is not the entirety of John's story. In fact, from the youngest of times, John developed kind of a passion slash obsession slash love for math, for complex problem solving, and found himself actually immersed in the world of math and mathematics from the time he was a little kid, teaching himself all sorts of things just for the fun of it. That ended up eventually landing him degrees in mathematics while simultaneously playing at Penn State for one of the biggest teams in the world in college. And then as he's wrapping up his pro career, making a decision to go back and pursue his PhD in math at MIT, which is actually where he was when I sat down with him to record this conversation. I love the way that he weaves together this deep passion and love for two worlds, for football and for math and complex problem solvings. It's really compelling. It's all laid out in a new book called Mind and Matter, A Life in Math and Football, which also has a pretty cool structure. He literally alternates chapters between math and football, which I thought was a fascinating way to travel the journey with him. And we travel that sort of parallel journey in this conversation. So excited to share it with you. I'm Jonathan Fields, and this is Good Life Project.
This podcast is brought to you by eHarmony, the dating app to find someone you can be yourself with. Why doesn't eHarmony allow copy and paste in first messages? Because you are unique, and your conversations should reflect that. eHarmony wants you to find someone who will get you. How are you going to know who gets you? If people send you the same generic conversation starters, they message everyone else. Conversations that actually help you get to know each other. Imagine that. Get who gets you on eHarmony. Sign up today.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Good Life Project is brought to you by Understood Explains, a podcast that's like a beacon for parents navigating the special education system. Hosted by Juliana Urtube, a special education expert, this season is all about individualized education plans, or IEPs. Juliana breaks down complex topics like how to tell if your child needs an IEP in a way that's easy to grasp. I checked out an episode of Understood Explains about the difference between IEPs and 504 plans, and I was struck by the balance of empathy and practical advice. It's not just about understanding the system. It's about empowering parents and caregivers to advocate for their children, which is just so important. So I've known a number of people who've had to literally scramble to figure out how to advocate for their kids when the system seemed to just make it so hard to get the support that they need and deserve. So if you're a parent navigating this world, or even just wondering if it's right for your family, I encourage you to give Understood Explains a listen. Search for Understood Explains in your podcast app. That's Understood Explains. It's like having a roadmap for a journey you didn't expect, making it a little less daunting. You've got this lifelong love affair with sort of like movement, with football, and with mathematics. And it feels like underneath that is just a profound interest in solving complex problems. And it sounds like a lot of that came from your mom. And she was probably pretty similarly wired to you.
Yeah, she was. She loved mathematics when she was younger, loved sort of quantitative things. And, you know, she ended up becoming a nurse, but this was largely due to, her feeling like, one, sort of a little self-conscious about her math abilities or her perceived lack thereof, and two, not really knowing what you could do with math and physics.
You mean like an apply in the real world?
Yeah, in the real world, in the sense that, okay, I'll tell you a little bit about my mother.
Yeah.
So she grew up in inner city Cincinnati in quite a rough area. Her father never graduated high school. He later got his GED. He worked at GM. Her mother stopped school after middle school because she was in the segregated South. And so there were schooling stopped after middle school and she became a seamstress. And so my mother, you know, she graduated from high school and she was the strongest student in her school. And despite that, you know, her guidance counselor actually recommended to her that, you know, rather than applying to university and going to college, that she should try to be a secretary. Not that there's anything wrong with being a secretary, but when you have sort of someone who's really interested in academics, to sort of push them away from college is a crazy thing to me. But thankfully, my mom didn't listen to her high school guidance counselor. She went to the local University of Cincinnati, and she really just, she wasn't really introduced to fields in STEM. And it's because of this that she, you know, eventually became a nurse. But I have to say that in general, it's tough to say you want to grow up and be something if you don't even know what that something is, or if you don't even know a single person who does that thing. And so that was one of the biggest things that sort of limited her. And that, I think, is one of the main reasons why she was so determined with me. Not determined to make me good at math because she was good at math, but she wanted to make sure that no matter what I was interested in, no matter what I wanted to be, that the only thing that would limit me would be either a lack of interest, a lack of talent, a lack of hard work, or perhaps just plain old bad luck. But she wanted to make sure that it would never have a single thing to do with a lack of resources, the household I was born into, or the color of my skin. And this is something that she truly believed in, especially based off her experiences. And so this is what she made sure of. And she saw that I was also quite good at quantitative things. And so she jumped on it, although she never pushed me. She just wanted to make sure I always had the resources.
Yeah. How did that start to show up? Because it seems like it showed up really early in your life.
Yeah. You mean, how did my...
In your sort of quantitative skills.
Yeah. How did she recognize this?
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is when I'm like really little. I can't even like say full sentences. But what I do know is I know all the shapes. And I love the shapes to the point where I see the shapes. And one of my favorite games, I'm told, I mean, who remembers what they were doing like before they were two? But I'm told that one of my favorite things to do when we like go outside would be to point and recognize the shapes that I see at home out in the world. Like recognize a square, recognize a rectangle, recognize what the stop sign is, things like this. Recognize a circle.
Mm. So she saw that and really started to nurture that. I mean, at the same time also, your mom, you're born actually in Canada, right?
Yeah, I was born in Winnipeg, Manitoba.
But then soon after moved to Buffalo.
Yes. After a few years, we ended up in Buffalo.
Right. And then your mom in this mix, because she went back to school also to be a lawyer.
Yes. Well, I mean, being a nurse was, first of all, sort of her schedule was quite tough. And she also wanted to try to sort of, you know, have a higher income and also have a job that might be a little more conducive to being able to raise me and give me the things that, you know, she thought I needed and deserved. And so, you know, it's not easy to do sort of in the middle of your life, in the middle of your career, to sort of go back to school at night and, you know, try to become something else. But she did it.
Yeah. I mean, especially because, you know, you got a kid. In the middle of this also, your parents ended up going their separate ways.
Yes, yes, so, they did.
So she ends up being effectively a single mom in Buffalo with a kid in a career like nursing, which not a lot of people leave. I mean, it's sort of like the medical professions. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, so once you start in there, as much as, you know, like there are a lot of great things and also a lot of real struggles that people talk about in those professions. It seems like it's the type of path where people kind of like, once you're in and you kind of just ride it out. So to be a single mom in Buffalo, raising a kid, a woman of color, and then say, I'm going to go back to school and completely change direction in careers. Yeah. I mean, powerful, disruptive. It's pretty incredible.
Yeah, no, my mother is a strong woman. Yeah. She is a strong, strong woman. And does not surprise me one bit. Like, knowing her,
yeah,
this does not surprise me. Yeah. If you told me this story abstractly, of course this is, you know, this is unusual, but knowing my mother, she...
just like, of course.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Your dad at the same time was a surgeon at the time.
Yes.
Talk to me a bit about sort of like you and him and that relationship in the early
days. We had such an interesting relationship when I was younger, I have to admit. I don't talk about it much. I simultaneously didn't feel that connected to my father. I wasn't that connected to my father sort of when I was young. But at the same time, I so desperately, desperately wanted to be just like him. To the point where, like, I would hang on his every word. It was like, his word was like, you know, it was like law to me. And the reason I became a football player, the reason I played football even in the first place, or even wanted to play football when I was younger, is because my father played college football. This was the single reason why I wanted to play football. And as I got older, I mean, in my sort of middle sort of teen years, my father, he lived in Boston at the time. He was the chief of surgery at Beth Israel Deaconess, I believe, Harvard's hospital in Boston.
Yeah, and, legendary hospital. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, he was really an extremely successful thoracic surgeon. And I also wanted to be just like him in the sense that I wanted to be really, really good at something. And eventually he, you know, he got a little burned out. He decided it's time to retire. He moved back to Buffalo right around, or he moved back to Canada, I should say, but not too far from me. And right around sort of, I believe, like seventh, eighth grade for me. And he came back and he decided that, I was out of shape. Decided that I was a little on the heavy side and that he was going to work with me. I was going to get in shape. And also he was going to help me with sort of my studies. And so he would pick me up after school every day. And the first thing we would do is we would go to the gym. He would like work me like a dog, like we're lifting weights. I'm running up and down stairs. And then we would go to the library and we would study. And this was such a sort of interesting time of my life and an experience that I really enjoyed. Like, I got into very good shape, and this was a time where I really got sort of introduced to a lot of areas of mathematics and physics that I wouldn't have been introduced to if it was just me and my mother, because my mother just, she just didn't know about, you know, about certain things.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting also just to me, the psychology of your dad sort of like, you know, like coming back, you know, closer to where you live now.
Yeah.
So you can be much more regular presence, but also showing up and saying like, hey, you're out of shape. We're going to do something about this. Did that land well with you? Did you reject that? Or were you just like, okay, let's do this?
I was
because it could be a lot of judgment that gets received by a lot of kids, depending on how it's offered.
Yeah, no, it's true. And my father is, he's a very, well, especially back then, he was a very direct person, and he's always been a very direct person, but I took it in the best way possible. I said, okay, we're going to do this, and I am going to, like, I'm going to lose weight. I am not going to, like, you know, I'm not going to be a fat kid, and I'm going to do this, and I'm going to enjoy it, and I'm going to do this with my father.
Yeah.
This is going to be a great thing, because I have to admit, I was sort of I was quite an overweight child sort of for a large number of years. I mean, I was, I'll admit, I was like, I was bullied when I was sort of in elementary school. And yeah, my weight was sort of an issue. And my father just said, you know what? We're fixing this now. And this is not going to be an issue for the rest of your life.
Nah.
Yeah.
And it kind of sounds like he said, we're doing this together, rather than you have to go do this.
Yeah.
Which
it's not
makes
like,
all the difference in the world.
Absolutely. It's not like he's saying, okay, it's not like he's just sitting somewhere and saying, oh, go run these stairs, go run these laps.
No.
We're doing them together. And that was something really enjoyable. And like, I would see like how much better my dad was at things than I was. Mm. And it made me just really, really want to like improve.
Yeah.
And I did. And to the point where now I'm constantly like beating him in races. I'm constantly outlifting him. And
like, how's that for him right now?
Yeah. Right. I mean, he predicted that's the way it was going to be. And, yeah, so I have to say, I have to really credit my father for a lot of things, that being like a really important time in my life. And also for him taking care of my, like my higher mathematics education. Hmm. Whereas my mother is sort of responsible for all the things that occurred when I was little, just her knowledge of mathematics, her knowledge of sciences, you know, it was limited. And so she can only do so much. And this is where my father really, really came in.
Yeah. It sounds like both of them also brought to you this ethos of you can do tough things. And almost, yeah. It's not just you can do tough things, but there's a certain joy to embracing them and working to be extraordinary, to be exceptional at almost anything. And there's nothing that if you set your mind to it, you know, you can't rise up and be, you know, among the best or accomplish incredible things at from both of them, because they both did it in their own domains in unique ways.
Absolutely. And they sort of taught me this in very different ways. Like my mother, this always came from a very sort of like loving, like enjoyment point of view. And my father really came at it from a much more sort of intense, hard work, sort of like sweat, tears sort of point of view. And I really needed both sides of that.
Yeah. Because I mean, along the way, if you want to become extraordinary at anything, you're going to have both experiences.
Yes.
No matter how much love for the game or the pursuit it is, there's going to come a time where you're like, this is just brutal.
Yeah, exactly.
And you got to push through. It's like hands down, push through.
Yeah. My mother always had sort of, you know, a lot of optimism, where my father is the realist.
Yeah. You mentioned also that time with your dad exposed you to the academic world in a completely different way. I know you tell a story about how you ended up, were you 13 years old or something like that, in a college class?
13. And this was completely, so here's just an example of sort of my mother versus my father. My mother has decided that my mother decided that I should be an aerospace engineer. Why? Because space was the most sort of amazing thing that she like could imagine. And she thought, well, the most brilliant quantitative minds in the world, they're all working on outer space. And so I need to be a rocket scientist and, you know, or aerospace engineer, as they're called. So my mother, like, she enrolls me in this summer camp for engineers, not just engineers, but African-American engineers. And I'm sure that this camp is fantastic for certain types of people. Perhaps it's fantastic for people who actually want to be engineers. But for me, it was quite dreadful. I found us sort of doing very, very hokey things, doing very sort of, you know, like making a little like bottle rocket with, you know, like baking soda or whatever, or, you know, using popsicle sticks to build bridges, things like this, which, you know, I'm sure some people really enjoy. But for me, it just didn't, I didn't get enjoyment out of this. I didn't see this as sort of a great use of sort of all the math and physics and all of the sort of complexity and sort of challenges that I'm used to doing. I just didn't really see it. And I didn't enjoy it. And my father said, you know what? Let's just forget this, you know, forget this camp, and let's just get you some real math. He said, the stuff with like popsicle sticks and all of this other thing, this is nonsense. Let's show you what math really is. And so he said, and at the time he was going back to school, getting his master's in economics. And so he says, you know what? I'm going to sign you up to audit this calculus course. And he bought me a calculus book. And first of all, I should say, it was the easiest calculus course we could find. It was calculus for business majors. It wasn't like your typical calculus course, but I really took to it. I really enjoyed it. And it was an amazing experience for me, I must say, because I was doing well. Like, I did well. It was at that point that I knew that I knew that, okay, you know what? I'm not bad at math, and this is something I enjoy. And
yeah.
I also experienced that through some of my father's courses he took because, okay, a lot of people might not know, but once you sort of get past the undergrad level of economics, it's very mathematics-based. For instance, in a PhD in economics, one of the first courses you take for microeconomics is something called measure theory, which is truly just mathematics. And so I would learn a lot from him through the courses he was taking and the things he was doing. I mean, he's the one who taught me what a matrix is and, you know, what a determinant is and things like this. So,
yeah, it's amazing also because, you know, when you talk about math, or for our international listeners, maths,
right? yes, of course.
Generally, especially, you know, like in the early years, the emotion that gets tied to it in an academic setting is not love. It's fear. And it's frustration and it's futility. And it's often, so many people talk about being scarred by their exposure to math at a really young age where like, and the goal becomes heads down, survive it and get to a place where you don't ever have to interact with it as soon as humanly possible. Mm-hmm. And something in your brain was wired. I mean, here's my curiosity, actually. It sounds like there were two things at play, and I'm curious how you experience this. Mm-hmm. You know, on the one side, it sounds like there's just something organic about you that is wired from the earliest age to somehow yearn for and interact with the experience of math and complex problem solving mm-hmm. in a way that's unique to you. And at the same time, I also wonder, you know, whether part of your love and embrace of it had to do with the way it was offered to you, or do you have a sense for what that blend might be?
Yeah, I do. First of all, I have to say that I was never, this is going to sound so strange, from the time I was born until until I got to college, there was not a single subject in mathematics, like in school, that I was ever truly taught. In the sense of I would pretty much get to just about every math class, more or less knowing the outline of everything and maybe just needing to be refreshed on some details. Because I learned these things years before from workbooks at home or workbooks that I would convince my parents to buy me from the bookstore, things like this. And so my learning experience in mathematics was very different than everyone else's. Everyone else is used to learning in a classroom. Teacher, you know, they introduce you to some formula. They show you a few examples on the homework. You just repeat it 20 times. You remember it. You know, whatever the formula or the sort of like quote unquote algorithm is to like factor or whatever it may be, you do it on the exam and then you forget about it. And my learning experience would be I would have some book on some subject. And rather than actually read the like section about like, you know, learning how to do certain things, I would just jump to the problems. I would just try to solve them without knowing how I'm supposed to solve them. And that became a really interesting experience, trying to solve a math problem without someone telling you the standard technique to solve it. And so you sort of feel like an explorer. You feel like a discoverer in some way. And so I would try these things and I would come up with my own ideas and my own techniques. And sometimes it would work, sometimes it wouldn't. When it wouldn't, I would go back to the chapter and learn, like, how do you do this? Why didn't I think of this idea? And if it did work, well, then I just didn't even go back to like how other people did it. I know how I do it. And this sort of learning experience and this sort of puzzle experience and the sense of discovery, this made my learning mathematics at home just an amazing, amazing endeavor. And okay, perhaps, you know, I have some proclivity to sort of puzzles and problem solving, but I don't think this is that unusual. I mean, I understand there's so many people who hate mathematics based off their experiences in schools, but how many people love puzzles? Like, how many people do Sudoku puzzles on the train? How many people love doing crossword puzzles? How many people sort of do you see anytime they're sort of idly having to get from one place to another or have some break playing some puzzle game on their phone? I think people do love puzzles. People do love that challenge in some ways. But I think often they don't see a connection between that and mathematics. Mm-hmm. Whereas when I learned mathematics, these two things were one and the same.
Yeah. And it also says something about you that you wanted to figure out not just the answer, but the way to the answer on your own. Mm-hmm. That's unusual. Yeah. Because most people would be like, show me the shortest way to get to this sign thing.
Yeah.
You're like, and then I'll bang it out. Like, I'll repeat it over and over.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're like, no. Like, I have the shortest way sitting in front of me in the chapter.
Yeah.
I don't want it. Like, it's like Richard Feynman's classic line when he won, like, you know, the Nobel Prize. He's like, you know, like, I don't care about the prize. Like, it was the kick of figuring the thing out.
Yeah.
Like, that was what lit him up. And his domain was, you know, like physics. Mm-hmm. Your domain was this, you know, broad category of this thing called math.
Yeah.
And I do agree. I think we all have that in some particular area or domain or topic. Mm-hmm. And I wonder often if it's just the way that we're often offered, you know, like the pursuit of math, closes maybe so many people who would be open to that off, mm-hmm. just because it's sort of like not offered in the way that maybe would really light that fire. I ended up freshman year of college, mm-hmm. one of my good friends and suite mates actually got there. He was like the classic, you know, like perfect score on the SAT guy. Mm-hmm. And he was in math. He showed up and his freshman year, he was TAing graduate level math courses because there was something about him, mm-hmm. you know? And I remember walking into his room one night and he's sitting there. It was like a Friday night, right? Mm-hmm. And everyone's getting ready to go out. He's sitting there with this advanced math textbook. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, what are you doing? He's like, I'm doing my problem sets. I'm like, I thought you finished those. He's like, no, I did all the assigned ones. He's like, I want to do all the rest of them in the book.
Yeah.
Just because this was like, there was no more fun thing that he could mm-hmm. think of doing. I'm like, wow, there are people like this.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's just it's what you enjoy if you've been introduced to it in the right way. I would compare this idea of, you know, sort of looking for the quickest way to do something and then just, you know, doing it and getting to the answer, you know, I equate it to, you know, if someone like, you know, if you're trying to solve some like Sudoku puzzle, why in God's name would you just find the answer and then just fill in the numbers, you know, like solving, like having the completed puzzle isn't the point.
Nah.
That's not the enjoyment. The enjoyment is getting from this blank piece of paper, this blank, you know, 9x9 grid to the answer.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I think so much of it has to come with understanding what needs to happen in your brain to make the leap from this being my job to this being the game.
Yeah.
You know, when it becomes play, then all of a sudden everything changes and you yearn to do mm-hmm. more of it.
Yeah. I mean, this is something that, you know, when I mentor young sort of would-be mathematicians, or even when I was mentored, when I was an undergraduate, it's the process is crucial. Mm. It's not about the results. It's about the process. My first research project with a brilliant professor, he did his undergrad and master's at Moscow State, PhD at Princeton, was a professor at Caltech, and was at Penn State for a time until Maryland bought him back from Penn State. But he would always tell me that, you know, okay, we were doing research in mathematical physics, celestial mechanics to be specific, but he would always tell me the right sort of ratio was about 80% learning and 20% research. And the point was the research we're doing is useless if I'm not learning. For us, you know, as a pair, it was not about me just proving this thing. It's not about the result. It's about my journey through proving this thing. It's my journey of learning and exploring and discovering and failing and failing and failing and failing and failing. And then, you know, finally breaking through that this was sort of the crucial part of our mathematical research, not the result, but sort of the process and the things I gained from it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what a powerful lesson when you zoom the lens out to the broader context of just life.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
If you can bring that frame to everything. And it also, it's sort of like it helps you stand in this place of a growth versus a fixed mindset.
Yeah.
You know? Because it's like, no, you're going to hit a lot of walls. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. Yeah. You know? It's, as long as you're sort of like understanding that and in the context and figuring out, okay, so what's my next move?
Mm-hmm.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Good Life Project is sponsored by Quince, a brand that is revolutionizing fashion. So their premium, durable apparel is sourced directly from top factories, bypassing the middleman, and their clothes are just so great and comfy to wear. I pretty much lived in their 100% Mongolian cashmere hoodie last winter, and now I just picked up a bunch of their Flowknit Breeze Performance tees in different colors. I just love the feel and the colors. And they also added 100% European linen button-down shirt, which feels so light and comfy. I'm so excited to be wearing it this summer. Quince offers luxury quality without the markups. And I also love Quince's commitment to ethical, responsible manufacturing. You'll feel good upgrading your wardrobe with stylish, values-aligned pieces. So upgrade your wardrobe. Go to quince.com/GLP for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/GLP, or just click the link in the show notes to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/GLP. Good Life Project is sponsored by NetSuite. So I remember when our businesses were just starting to really scale. It was amazing and also added complexity and stress. And the things that I used to do in hours were taking days, too many spreadsheets, too many systems, no single source of truth. If that sounds familiar, you should know these numbers. 37,000, 25, and 1. 37,000 businesses have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25. NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And 1, because your business is one of a kind. So you get a customized solution for all of your key performance indicators in one efficient system with one source of truth, manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. Everything you need to grow all in one place. And right now, download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/goodlife. That's netsuite.com/goodlife to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/goodlife. Good Life Project is sponsored by Lexus GX. So have you ever owned something that inspired you to just up your game? For me, it was this high-end mountain bike. I love the ultralight frame, the suspension, the precision gearing, and I realized it deserved to be ridden to its full potential. So I started training harder so I could experience the joy it could give back to me. And it paid off. That bike helped me discover just new levels of performance and straight up joy. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Imagine tackling rugged landscapes with the available 33-inch all-terrain tires and multi-terrain select, then unwinding with the available front row massaging seats. This is a vehicle that inspires you to go further, to live up to its full potential. So why settle? Live up to the all-new Lexus GX, luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer. So simultaneously, with as you're developing this love, this mad passion, you also get exposed to the world of football. You end up in a private high school in Buffalo. And it seems like this is really the first time that football enters your life in a much, I mean, you had the, you knew that your dad had played in college and that was like kind of like a cool thing for you.
Yeah.
But it really enters your life when you step into high school.
Yeah, no, it does. And, you know, I wanted to play because of my father. And, you know, the first time I started playing, I have to say, I really took to it. My technique was awful. I barely knew how to put the pads on. But it turns out I was quite good at hitting people, and coaches caught on to this. So, yeah, and so it all went from there.
So you start playing, and so you're simultaneously in high school. You're great student, you're going deeper and deeper into math, and you're also really excelling as a football player.
Yes.
Comes time where you hit the end of high school and you've got some decisions to make.
Yeah, but okay, in my mind, there weren't really, you know, there wasn't really much in the way of decisions in that I was very interested in football.
Yeah.
And I have to say, I wasn't nearly as interested in math as an academic pursuit.
Okay.
In the sense of, okay, I knew a lot of math. I was very, very good at math. Everyone knew this. But my experiences with math didn't feel extremely academic. So why would I be at all interested in or at all excited about sort of more of the same in college?
Mm.
You know what I mean? I'll take my math classes. You know, I'll just do my stuff. People will leave me be. And yeah, so I wasn't like sort of excited for, you know, for college in terms of academics, but I was very excited about the prospect of playing college football.
Yeah. And so coming out of high school, I mean, you start to have interesting opportunities.
Yeah.
You know, and it seems like there's also this interesting tension that starts to arise between you and your mom about sort of like, what's the right choice here?
Me and my mom and also my father and my mom. So
interesting.
My father had strong opinions. My mother had strong opinions. And I was sort of somewhere in the middle.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, for instance, my mother, first of all, she didn't even want me to play football. She, you know, she wanted me to, you know, just do my undergrad at, you know, like at Princeton or an MIT or a Stanford. And my father, he was very big on the football. And to start, it seemed like I was going to play football at Princeton, which felt like a very sort of good agreement between the three of us. But then my senior year, I started getting interest from, you know, slightly bigger programs. And so the University of Buffalo offers me a scholarship. And at this point, I really have no other offers. And my mother says, absolutely not. He's going to Princeton. I mean, it's Princeton versus the University of Buffalo. And my father says, no. He needs to play football at the University of Buffalo because the quality of football is sort of much, much better. And like, football at Princeton's going to be dreadful, and he can get a good education there, and he can do his, you know, his master's or his PhD at a different program. And so I was very uncertain what I was going to do. My father and mother sort of, you know, opposed in terms of what is the right call. And then I got interest from the likes of Penn State, Boston College, and Stanford. And sort of with Penn State, we all came to a good middle ground. My mother needed the most convincing. I mean, my father, of course, at Penn State, yes, you need to go there.
Penn State's like classic at that point, classic D1 football.
Yes. High level, you know, right. This is like a dynasty.
Yeah.
Lots of tradition.
It sounds like you went there, you verbally committed.
Yeah.
And then like at the last minute, there was like a tiny glitch with a call from Stanford.
Yeah. So as soon as the weekend was over, like the next Monday, the Harbaugh, the coach of Stanford at the time, gives me a phone call, and there was an issue in that the person who was recruiting me, the offensive line coach at Stanford, resigned. And so they were sort of scrambling to, you know, find out who he was recruiting and get, you know, things on track. And when he sort of called me, I had already committed to Penn State. And although Stanford was actually like my dream school, I told him no, because, you know, I felt like I had committed to Penn State. I had given them my word. And, you know, I felt like it was very important to me that I stand by my word.
Mm. That must have been a hard moment, especially at that age. Because, I mean, we're talking about like an 18-year-old kid who's making a decision to choose Penn State over Stanford because at that age, your word matters that much to you. That's unusual.
It wasn't that hard of a decision at all. I mean, he calls me. This is going to sound great. I didn't even really think about it.
Mm.
Like, it wasn't like I had some big internal struggle. I said, no. I gave them my word. I have to stick by this.
So you end up in Penn State.
I end up at Penn State.
And the first year redshirted, which is, for explain what that actually
means. Yes, for our non-American football, for people who aren't familiar with American football or who might be international, the idea is that you're at university, you're a part of the team, but you don't play in any of the games. And the point of this is that that year does not count towards your 4 years of eligibility, like 4 years of which you're eligible to play for your team. So this is common not just in football, but in other sports. In football, it's most common for offensive linemen to sort of be so-called redshirted, which was my position, because you have to be very big, you have to be very strong. And so an extra year to allow, you know, a young 17-year-old boy to develop, this is almost a no-brainer. It's also common, just as a side note, in some other sports, like it's decently common in track and field.
I didn't realize that.
And it's interesting because, you know, I had some friends who did track. It comes at surprising times. Like oftentimes people will take a random red shirt their junior year or some such thing.
Huh. Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah. I always thought it was freshman year.
Yeah. I always thought it was freshman year too, until I sort of saw this phenomena where you'll have runners taking red shirts in like sophomore year or junior year in some random year.
Yeah. So interesting.
Yeah.
So you're redshirted first year.
Yes.
You start to play after that. Pretty quickly, you're starting.
Yeah.
And you become, you know, like a well-known, established player on the team.
Yeah.
Simultaneously with this, you're also academically. Were you right in math and from the beginning there?
No. So I started out in aerospace engineering because my mom told me I was going to be an aerospace engineer, but I didn't enjoy my engineering classes that much.
Yeah.
And I found that my college math courses were my favorite. I was like enjoying my math courses a lot more because they felt a lot closer to the way that I learned math when I was younger. Mm. Like we're getting closer to sort of learning math from a rigorous point of view and also not being so focused on the result, but the process. Like now that we're in college and sort of I'm taking higher level math classes, no one is just showing you a formula. No one is just sort of hand waving and say, okay, now we use this and we do it 10 times. They are justifying every single thing that they do. And they're so focused on the process. And they're not so focused about the result, but the question of why. Why is this true? Why can we use this? Whereas my engineering courses, first of all, tons of people become engineers. It's a great profession, but they were extremely focused on how. And sort of growing up, I was always a why person, much more than a how person. And so my math courses really sort of spoke to me, and I switched majors and I didn't even tell my mother.
So you're, it's interesting too, right? So you're kind of continuing to live this dual life at the same time, you know, like very public, very forward-facing on the football field, mm-hmm. on TV, yeah. Performing at the highest level as an athlete, and then pursuing and performing at the highest level as an academic in the field of math. Mm-hmm. Did you feel as you're sort of living this life, did you feel like you were living two separate lives? Were they just a seamless integration? Did one inform the other, or did you even examine that at the time?
I didn't even examine it, and I can say they fit together seamlessly. Not because they needed to have something particular in common, but that they had, you know, something very simple in common, that I truly loved both. And to be great at either of them, it took talent, but it took a lot of hard work. It took a lot of dedication. It took a lot of love, because it's not always easy. And these are the characteristics that allowed me to be great at both of these things.
Yeah, because it really seems, if you talk about pursuing, you know, like athletic performance in Division I school at the highest level, most people will tell you that takes 110% of your effort.
Yeah.
And then to be at the top of your class academically, mm-hmm. that takes 110% of your effort.
Yeah.
And somehow,
220%
right. You're the math guy.
It's higher than 100. How does this work? Yes.
But you're just like heads down. It sounds like so much of it came from that mindset that was instilled from your folks, like in the earliest days. It's like, you can do hard things. You put your head down and you just work to make it happen. It shall be.
Yes. Yes.
In the middle of your time in Penn State, this was also a really interesting and hard time. At Penn State because mm-hmm. of what happened.
Yeah. In my opinion, it was the perfect time for me to be at Penn State, actually. So, I'll talk about this a little bit. So at Penn State, there was this football coach, a guy by the name of Jerry Sandusky, who was sort of an extremely sort of praised football coach. He, you know, he was a linebackers coach. Penn State is often called Linebacker U. I can't tell you the exact years he coached, but I know he retired right around 2001, I believe. And so in 2011 or 2012, allegations came out about this retired coach, Jerry Sandusky, regarding child abuse, and in particular, raping young boys. And when this came out, I recall what I was doing. We were on a bye week, which means we didn't have a game, and it was the weekend, and I was doing math and hanging out, and I saw this news sort of about, you know, like former Penn State football coach is charged with, you know, I don't even know what the legal term for it is, but I saw this, and the first thing I thought is, who's Jerry Sandusky? Because I have no clue who this person is. And I didn't really think anything of it until like a day or two later on Monday, when, you know, I show up to the building and there's cameras everywhere, there's reporters everywhere, and it's this huge circus. And why is it a circus? Well, first of all, this is just an awful thing. You know, this man, this former Penn State football coach, raping young boys. But even more so was the fact that sort of he was really doing so sort of with a whole community sort of fooled and ignorant and unaware. And it was just, first of all, it was just unfathomable. And okay, I mean, this has been sort of a really enjoyable podcast on sort of a high note, but, you know, to talk about this, it was a time in my life that really changed my perspective of the world and changed my perspective of people in the following way. So there was a lot of scandal going on and lots of things, but one of the things that I want to sort of touch on that I think is interesting is this man managed to convince an entire university, an entire town, an entire community that he was a good person. And imagine you're this awful, evil person. You have this awful, like, evil habit. And most people, I think, would try their best to hide it, to try their best to do this in secret. This man started a nonprofit charity called The Second Mile, which actively sought out young boys without father figures from underserved backgrounds. And he used this charity to feed him young boys who he was easily capable of exploiting. And an entire university and community unknowingly helped him do this. And this man was even able to convince people who I knew and I thought and I know quite well, who I consider to be bright, intelligent people. He managed to fully convince them that he's innocent. He's completely innocent. And this time in my life is when I truly, truly learned just how dangerous it is when you have a very smart, a very brilliant person who is also evil. This is a scary, scary combination. I didn't think a person was capable of doing such a awful feat, of having such, I knew people were capable of doing, you know, awful things, but capable of doing awful things and doing them so cunningly. I mean, yes, this man was caught. He was caught when he was 70. He's been doing this for decades and decades and decades. Like, it was just a crazy time. And, okay, sort of our role in this as Penn State football players, this is minuscule compared to what's going on. But I was happy to be there at that time because I can say wholeheartedly, Penn State is an amazing place. It's a beautiful university. I loved playing football there so much. Like, this was the favorite part of my football career, playing football on Saturdays in front of 106,000 with all of my best friends. I mean, these are the guys you live with, you eat with, you sort of go out with, you hang out with. And a university that's given me so much that, you know, I feel like I'm a part of the Penn State family. I am. And to show the world that, no, Penn State is a great place full of amazing people doing great things, and one man does not define the university. And I was really glad to be there at that time to be a part of that, to give back to a university that's given me so much.
Yeah, because, I mean, it seemed like the as this whole story unfolded, and it unfolded in a very public way.
Yes.
There was a very, you know, like the media loves to sort of like tell one big homogenous story about, mm-hmm. you know, it's not, it was the man. And then, you know, like soon after we found out, you know, like Paterno gets basically the entire staff, the coaching staff ends up, you know, exiting. And yes. I guess Paterno had planned on leaving before that anyway. He was planning on leaving anyway. But anyway,
yes.
everything sort of like the web runs out and it gets yes. very dark.
Yes.
I think a lot of the public narrative is that, you know, like, this is a bad place. This is yes. a dark place. Like, there's no distinction between, you know, like what happened within a particular arena context and group of people within
yes.
the institution and the entirety of the institution, the entire history of it, and
yes.
the entire student body that was there at the time.
Yes.
You know, there was a broad stroke that got painted in the public discourse, it feels like. So it's so interesting for me to be able to talk to you about that experience from being there, from being a part of that team and mm-hmm. living it from the inside out
yeah.
and how you experienced and like your decision to want to tell that fuller story and play sort of like a role in being public about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they sort of said that this one specific thing was sort of a clear sign that Penn State as a university has serious, serious issues. And sort of was sort of very condemning of this place. And I have to say that it's probably hard to believe unless you're there. And, you know, if, you know, a lot of people, you might not like believe that this man is capable of all that I'm claiming he is capable of, but it was shocking to me. And it was shocking just the ability that this one person had to literally fool an entire community. And as crazy, I mean, it sounds absurd. And, you know, this is what I mean when I say it really changed my worldview. Hmm. Like, I didn't realize people like this, like, truly existed. When you see it up close, when you talk to people that you know and you really respect, and they fully believe that this man is innocent. That's just like, that's a testament to me to just show how unreasonably good this man was and still is at convincing people of something in light of overwhelming evidence.
As you said, the impact on the people who were victimized is not to be understated. And at the same time, you were going through, you know, the effect that this had just on a practical day-to-day way on you and on the team was also just sort of devastating. You know, it was, it the entire staff was essentially, you know, like exited. New people were brought in. The governing body is effectively, you know, like made it brutally hard for the team to function, mm-hmm. Let alone to recruit new players and all this stuff. And look, like without going, we're not going to go into that rabbit hole of whether that was appropriate or inappropriate. Mm-hmm. It was just, it made it very hard for you to be somebody who was there doing something that you absolutely loved. And then seeing so many of the people who led this effort leave, dealing with the social context of what was happening mm-hmm. on around you. And then at the same time, knowing that what was happening with the team, the limitations that the mm-hmm. NCAA had sort of yes. imposed, making it brutally hard to yeah. do the very thing that you love to wake up yeah. in the morning mm. to do.
And I will say I'm happy to actually briefly tackle that question
yeah.
those things with the NCAA. I mean, they effectively tried to sort of completely end the Penn State football program without giving us the death penalty. It certainly was not fair. I feel very comfortable saying this, but it pales in comparison to sort of the broader injustice that was done in this sort of, in this situation. It pales in comparison. It's not even comparable.
Yeah.
And that's sort of my, that's my personal view on it.
Yeah. Good Life Project is sponsored by Lexus GX. So have you ever owned something that inspired you to just up your game? For me, it was this high-end mountain bike. I love the ultralight frame, the suspension, the precision gearing, and I realized it deserved to be ridden to its full potential. So I started training harder so I could experience the joy it could give back to me. And it paid off. That bike helped me discover just new levels of performance and straight up joy. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Imagine tackling rugged landscapes with the available 33-inch all-terrain tires and multi-terrain select, then unwinding with the available front row massaging seats. This is a vehicle that inspires you to go further, to live up to its full potential. So why settle? Live up to the all-new Lexus GX. Luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
So you end up staying there.
Yes.
You actually end up finishing your undergrad early and then committing to a master's there. And even though there were certainly, you know, there was a curiosity about going somewhere else, potentially back to Stanford, or you stay there, you finish out your time. And then as you're finishing out your time there, you get to a point where three initials, three letters, you know, started to become a part of your conversation at NFL.
You know,
am I actually, do I have the opportunity, or is it possible for me to actually go pro? When did that as a real opportunity really first start to enter the conversation for you?
After my junior year. Yeah, it wasn't until after my junior year. I mean, people would mention this to me a little bit, but I didn't really pay too much attention. I didn't think it was a real thing. And really, I was just focusing on like being an offensive lineman in the Big Ten. I mean, this is something I dreamed of when I was younger. Like, I would watch like Michigan and Jake Long on TV. And I thought, wow, I want to be an offensive lineman in the Big Ten. Like, this was my biggest football dream.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also at the time, you're what, 6'3", 220, 230. And the guys who are playing your position in the NFL are like kind of dwarf you.
Yeah, like
you know, to imagine that is kind of hard to imagine, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
but, yeah, when you're in, yeah, when you're a high school kid,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so and at the same time, you're you know, you've got stunning academics. You have mm-hmm. a world of opportunity being offered to you there.
Yes.
What was it that made you that kind of like put the weight on the scales that said I'm going to see if I can actually do this?
Well, I started getting a lot of interest. I started getting a lot of sort of like signals that, John, you're probably going to be drafted. This was before my senior year. Mm. You're probably going to be drafted, and you're going to be drafted like, you know, decently high. And I thought, you know what? I love football. I've been playing football for so long. Let's play football at the highest level. Let's experience this. Let's do this. You can only do this once. You know, you only have one chance. You know, if I sort of finished my career at Penn State and went to start a PhD, there's no going back, really. And so I thought, no, let's do this.
Mm. Yeah. Sort of like I can always pursue the PhD and what.
Yeah, I can always pursue the PhD later.
This is my one shot. Yeah.
This is my one shot. And my father was very big on sort of the NFL as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So the draft comes around, and
yes.
For those who don't know, the way that basically there's a 3 or 4 day window.
Yeah, like a 3 day window.
3 day window, yeah, right? Where you know, out of 15,000-20,000 potential people who could be eligible. There are like 200 to 300 spots.
Yeah.
And then the teams essentially based on, you know, like certain rankings and privileges, they just start going down a list.
Yeah.
Picking players. And this happens over a period of 3 days. And, you know, everyone kind of knows like all the top guys who are going first and second.
Yes.
You get, you know, like 3 days in, I guess.
Yeah. So I'm on the third day.
Right. Your name still hasn't been called. What's going through your mind?
Yeah, it was, I knew I was going to be, okay, no one ever knows they're going to be drafted, but I knew with very high probability I would be drafted. But I waited much longer than expected. It's a bad sign when you go to like Yahoo Sports and the single best available player across all positions is you for like a number of picks. This is, and when you're on like Mel Kiper's, like, best available pick after pick after pick. This is not where you want to be. You want to be, or at least I want to be, you want to be the pick where our team picks you and they said, wow, we really didn't expect this player to go this high. You don't want to be the player where, you know, they pick you and they say, we were so surprised they managed to get this player this late. And I was the latter.
Mm.
Yeah.
Right before you actually get picked up eventually by the Ravens, Baltimore Ravens. You got a phone call right before the draft.
Yeah.
What was that about?
Yeah. So right before I got drafted, you know, the Ravens call me and, you know, they're making small talk. They call everyone before they draft them just to talk to you and, you know, things like this. And yeah, they were having some fun with me. So, you know, making lots of small talk.
Yeah. It sounds like also they were trying to suss out one final thing, which is that because they're putting it like they have a fixed number of choices.
Yes.
You know, and if they take you on, then they're saying no to somebody else.
Yeah, exactly.
Sounds like what they were trying to suss out also was like, okay, so here's a guy who's extraordinary at this, but he also has tremendous other opportunity. Like,
yes.
Are you legit in on football?
Yes.
Like only football?
Yeah.
Huh. Yeah. So you end up signing with Baltimore Ravens.
That's true.
So you are a pro player.
Yes.
What's it like the first day that you show up there?
Yeah, I just I keep my head down and I get to work. This has always been my attitude anytime I'm in a new place, in a new environment. Keep my head down, don't say anything, don't cause any attention. Just learn and work hard.
Yeah.
And good things will happen.
And good things do indeed happen. So you end up, you know, on the field relatively quickly,
yes.
Playing, doing really well, and not too far into your career, you also get hit.
Yeah.
And you get a concussion. And
yeah.
It sounds like a pretty substantial one.
Yeah.
Which brings up a whole another issue, which is, you know, and this has become a big part of the public conversation mm-hmm. around football these days also, which is concussion and how that can lead to CTE, which is short for, what is it? Basically traumatic brain injury. And it's not quite it. It's actually, it's sort of like the degradation of brain tissue over time from repeated hits, but I'm forgetting what the initials stand for.
Although, there's no expert on this in this room.
Yeah.
Sadly. But,
right.
But yes, this is the gist of it.
Yeah. And there's research that starts to come out that starts to show to examine the brains of actually deceased football players, pro players, and show some really alarming things.
Some alarming, but very misleading.
So tell
alarming,
me,
but very
talk
misleading.
Talk me through this.
In the sense that it's alarming because, okay, they sort of do this and they show certain numbers. And I have to say I've become like far too familiar with this sort of particular research article than I ever really wanted to be. But because now, like, because, okay, I retire sort of right around when this comes out.
Right.
So now everyone's asking me about it. So now I need to, now I feel like responsibility to like, okay, now I really need to know what's going on because everyone's bothering me about this thing. And so I'm more qualified to talk about this than I ever wanted to, than I ever would want to be, or I do want to be. But the idea is the headline is something along the lines of, you know, they test brains of deceased football players and the percentage of brains that had like CT, I think it was like, what was it? 98%, 99%
like that,
or some very high number. But, first of all, just that title in itself is, and the way sort of like, you know, the media picks up on this, or I forget what the exact title was, but, I mean, this is sort of sensationalism in a sort of very strong way. And because the idea is, yes, okay, it's not that they've sort of like, it's not that they've, you know, said certain brains have degradation when they don't, but sort of the very act of asking people if they'd like to donate their brains for this study is already a self-selection bias.
It's like a selection bias, yeah.
Because what sort of former NFL player would say, yes, I would love to donate my brain in particular to a study about long-term effects of brain injuries in the NFL. Well, who's going to sign up for this? People who are suffering from sort of like issues or have some strong suspicions about this. So it's sort of misleading, although the article does mention this issue, sort of the headlines don't. And I would say that what is the actual percentage? It's not 99%. It's not even close to 99%. It's also certainly not 0%. And it's not extremely, extremely close to 0% either. And so there's, you know, it's somewhere in between. But I think the sort of like sensationalism of this sort of was a little out of hand.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting to hear that lens on it, especially because you look at it from the, okay, so this is an interesting problem.
Yeah.
You know, and there are data points and there are assumptions. And like, how do we go about like finding out what's the truth here?
Yeah. And I'll say that this is actually, when I talk about mathematics, this is one of the key uses. And this is one of the sort of, this is one of the reasons why math is so important. Not just if you're going to be a scientist or a mathematician or work in STEM, because you need to be able to think quantitatively in life, no matter what you become. Because if you don't, all of a sudden, you're going to have a really hard time coping and interacting with things in this world. Understanding what, you know, a certain loan means. Deciding between two different choices and figuring out which one is better. Or I would argue sort of perhaps most importantly is being able to understand pieces of information that you're told and to be able to understand what it actually means and whether or not you believe it and what's inherently sort of latent in that statement that you've just been told. And I would recommend for readers, okay, first of all, I'm here and of course we're talking about my book, but perhaps it's bad form to talk about someone else's book when you're on a podcast talking about your book, but this book, How Not to Be Wrong by Jordan Ellenberg, is a fantastic read. And it really addresses this concept of quantitative literacy for sort of functioning in this world. Because if you don't understand what, you know, a certain statistic really says or what is hidden in that statistic, you're much more likely to be easily misled.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you could kind of zoom the lens out, and, you know, we keep using the word math.
Yeah.
But it seems like the bigger thing that really, really connects you with it, and you're referencing here, is it's a process of discovering what's real, a process of discovering, yes, like what is true and what is not true.
Yes.
And trying to move towards an outcome. It's like a process of proof.
Yeah.
Which fundamentally comes down to decision making, you know, and,
yeah,
and making better decisions in life and finding out what is real, what is not real, and what is provable, what is not provable, and finding joy along the way.
It's actually, I have to say, it's interesting because, you know, often I'll talk to, you know, some of my friends about things, especially perhaps some of my friends who, you know, maybe are in history or, yeah, well, perhaps one of my friends in particular who's in history and very interested in sort of certain social issues. And we'll often talk about things and, you know, he'll talk about certain statistics to me. And I'm always so, you have to be so skeptical. And I think a healthy level of skepticism for everything you're told is a really great thing. Not to like really doubt people, but when you hear something, to ask yourself, what's hidden here? Are there any sort of confounding variables that sort of I should think about? Is there any way in which this thing I'm being told is sort of not directly related to the conclusion that it's trying to lead me towards in some way? And so sort of thinking sort of critically, I think, is a really powerful tool.
Yeah.
When you take in information in this world.
What's that famous line? There lies, damn lies, and then statistics.
Yeah.
I want to start to come full circle a bit with you,
yeah,
also. So you end up playing.
Yes.
You do have a concussion, but you come back completely fine.
Yeah.
And you make the choice that, like, that I'm going to keep going.
Yeah.
But not too long after, you also decide that it's time to actually stop playing.
Yeah.
And you go back and you decide, okay, so now it's time to dive back in and pursue your PhD at,
yes,
MIT.
Yes.
As we sit here now, are you currently in the program? Or
yes, I have
out?
One more year left.
Okay.
So I'm graduating next spring.
Right. What's your intention? I mean, do you have, are you just awash in the joy of discovery, or do you
am. So it's almost a little bit like my senior year at Penn State.
Yeah.
I'm sort of awash in the joy, but I'm sadly becoming more and more aware that, like, I need to prepare for what comes next.
Yeah. What is that, do you have a sense?
Yes, for me, it's academia.
Mm.
I love discovery. I love research. But a passion that I haven't had a chance to talk about here, but I mean, okay, we can only talk for so long, but I really enjoy inspiring young people. And I love teaching. And part of this is born out of the gifts I've been given through a specific professor and, you know, multiple professors who took a real interest in me and who sort of without them, I certainly wouldn't be a mathematician. You know, I find it important that I do that as well. And I want to do that in the form of being a math professor.
Hmm. Love that. So as we sit here in the context of this conversation,
yes,
Good Life Project, if I offer out the phrase to live a good life, what comes up?
To do what you love, I would say.
Hmm.
To live a good life, it's to do what you love. And for me right now, it's solving hard math problems, trying to show other people the beauty of math, perhaps in a way that they're not used to seeing it, inspiring young people, and spending lots of time with my daughter.
Mm. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for listening, and thanks also to our fantastic sponsors who help make this show possible. You can check them out in the links we have included in today's show notes. And while you're at it, if you've ever asked yourself, what should I do with my life? We have created a really cool online assessment that will help you discover the source code for the work that you're here to do. You can find it at sparketype.com. That's SPARKETYPE. TYPE.com, or just click the link in the show notes. And of course, if you haven't already done so, be sure to click on the subscribe button in your listening app so you never miss an episode. And then share the love. If there's something that you've heard in this episode that you would love to turn into a conversation, share it with people and have that conversation. Because when ideas become conversations that lead to action, that's when real change takes hold. See you next time.